Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, I want to mention that KABU is in the midst of our spring membership drive. KABU is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by people like you. Not only that, KABU has trained thousands of people how to make radio all for free, thanks to the support we receive from our members. So help us reach our $56,000 fundraising goal. Your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $12,000 thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. The regenerative farming movement has mostly centered around restoring soil and ecosystem health and leaving our land, waters, and climate in better shape for future generations. But regenerative farming also requires reckoning with our nation's agricultural history that is marked by discrimination and displacement. And ultimately, it requires dismantling power structures that have blocked many farmers of color from owning land or building wealth. Today we talk with Liz Carlisle, author of Healing Grounds, which tells the stories of indigenous Black, Latinx, and Asian American farmers who are reviving their ancestors' methods of growing food, techniques long suppressed by the industrial food system. Liz, welcome to Locus Focus.
Great to be here, Barbara.
Well, I wanted to start by reading an excerpt from the introduction to your book, Healing Grounds, that I think sets up this whole story about regenerative farming in a way that's very different from any other description or exploration of this issue. So you say, both human atrocities and environmental destruction stem from European society's effort to remake the world in their image. In this way, the American heartland has been broken. By the moldboard plows of settlers, yes, but simultaneously by the larger forces of which those plows are part and parcel, genocide, colonization, agriculture as domination. The story of violence in agriculture was fundamentally a story about racial violence. So we're going to talk today not just about how to store more carbon in the soil, but why a lot of ways in which carbon was stored in the soil for eons has been destroyed by the very forces you're talking about. So let's start with the perspective that you started this whole project with, because you were interested in regenerative agriculture. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I've always been interested in talking to farmers who are trying to shift agriculture from being an environmental problem, you know, which it very much is in terms of the dominant agricultural system in the U.S. today, to being an environmental solution. And in these times, I'm particularly interested in this shift from agriculture as a climate problem to a climate solution. And I found that my colleagues had very different estimates of just how many greenhouse gas emissions regenerative agriculture could mitigate. Some people said, oh yeah, 20 to 35% of human-caused greenhouse gas emissions can be mitigated by these regenerative agricultural practices. And then others of my colleagues were like, nope, it's all smoke and mirrors in a marketing campaign. And so I was like, huh, that's a very large discrepancy between zero and 20 to 35%. So what's going on there? And is regenerative agriculture really a climate solution?
So is it? What did you find out?
Yeah. So that was the question that brought me to this book. And long story short, you know, what I found is that all forms of regenerative agriculture aren't created equal. And so it really depends on what you mean by regenerative agriculture. If what you mean is, you know, we're going to keep the logic of the food system pretty much as is right now, we're going to keep this kind of extractive industrial system in place, but we're going to do a little no-till and we're going to plant a few cover crops, that isn't really going to do much to solve the climate crisis. But if you're taking the word regeneration, you know, to heart and saying we're actually going to heal the extraction and the damage caused by this agricultural system over the past, you know, few hundred years, that's one of the most powerful climate solutions I know of. And it, you know, what we're talking about in that case is reshaping our society's relationship with land away from extraction and towards a reciprocal relationship, you know, that, by the way, indigenous communities have, you know, been practicing and trying to get the rest of us to adopt for a long time.
Well, I want to talk, before we get into the what you might consider true regenerative agriculture, into some of the methods that have been promoted over the last 15, 20, 30 years, maybe. The first one comes to mind because the first time I heard of the term, it was actually regenerative grazing, and it was being promoted by this South African guy, Alan Savory. And it sounded really great. And in fact, I interviewed a woman who wrote about it, a book called Cows Can Save the World. So I was wondering what you knew about that and how that jibes with what you've learned.
Yeah. So, you know, I also sort of started out by hearing about a series of practices that I'm originally from Montana. Most of the folks that I first got to know when I got interested in sustainable agriculture were folks who were in a sort of wheat agriculture system and trying to figure out how to diversify their crops and maybe kind of get off of chemical fertilizers and herbicides. And so some of those folks did have cattle or neighbors who had cattle. And so grazing and trying to do grazing in a different way that mimicked native herbivores was one of the things that would come up. You know, other kinds of things that would come up as ways to move towards regeneration, if you're starting with, you know, wheat monoculture, would be planting a soil-building cover crop, particularly in the winter, or just diversifying the crop rotation to have more diversity. And, you know, where everybody was sort of headed was acknowledging that this is a prairie. And we need to farm in ways that look more like a prairie ecosystem. And so what that means is, you know, we need more perennial plants because a prairie would mostly be comprised of perennial plants, not annual plants like wheat. And we need more polyculture. We need more diversity represented on the landscape. And so, you know, it seemed to me that where people were limited in moving in that direction of creating a farm that looked more like a prairie, it had everything to do with economic and policy factors. And the folks who were having more success ecologically were people who had created something, some kind of business model or collaboration, a circle of people with whom they could imagine another world that allowed them to kind of expand beyond the idea that a farm has to look like a wheat monoculture and just like envision, there could be lentils. That was one of the first things that I learned about, is this group of farmers in Montana rotating in lentils. Most of the farmers I've talked to who've been implementing these kinds of practices have been frustrated by the larger economy in which they have to operate, the markets that they're trying to serve and the kind of logic that underpins them, or sort of what kinds of agricultural services or technical assistance are available in their neighborhood. So, regenerative grazing is kind of one of these attempts to kind of move towards how could agriculture look more like the natural ecosystem it's embedded in. But sort of by itself, it falls short.
Well, I got the impression from talking to people that it's kind of based on some fallacies, one of them being that it's very hard to use techniques that might work in South Africa, which is a lot wetter than North Dakota or Eastern Montana, and put it there. And a lot of conditions are different. And the other part of it was that they were encouraging running thousands of head of cattle, which I understand can be very destructive to the land, even if you're trying to crowd them together, which is one of the things, and moving where they graze. I was very interested in the first story that you tell in Healing Grounds about a very different approach to regenerative grazing. So let's talk about what the indigenous approach to that would be.
Yeah, so I think you're absolutely right. If you want to think about regenerative grazing in the North American prairie, the place to start isn't a model from another continent. The place to start is the history of regenerative grazing by native herbivores in partnership with native people on the North American prairie. And so I had the opportunity to interview Latrice Tatsy, who's a member of the Blackfeet Nation in what's now Northwest Montana. And she has a really interesting position in all of this because her family are cattle ranchers and also advocates of bison restoration. So she is continuing work that actually was started by her father, who got involved in bison restoration pretty early with their community. And she is now a researcher at Montana State University. She's finishing up a graduate degree there. And what she's interested in studying is she's comparing pastures with buffalo grazing and pastures with cattle grazing. And she's interested in the impact on the soil, microbial community, soil health, and carbon sequestration. And her interest, she's a big believer that restoring buffalo to their homelands, bringing these relatives home, is really powerful healing for the ecosystem. And there's a lot of research to back that up. And she also believes that observing the behavior and the grazing patterns of these buffalo can be instructive to indigenous cattle producers who, you know, it's a complex issue in the face of colonization for many indigenous prairie peoples. Ranching cattle was a way to continue some of the land relationships and life ways that they had, even in the face of a lot of oppression. And so now you have cattle who are part of this community. And, you know, Latrice does really, I think, brilliant, sensitive work with tribal ranchers. You know, she's not one of these folks who are just saying, we're going to get rid of all the cows and it's all going to be bison. She sees actually a future of coexistence. And she sees that there was, you know, multi-species grazing on the prairie previously. So I think the big lesson that she's learned and that she sort of passed on to me from bison grazing is that, yeah, these are herbivores that evolved, you know, for a long time with prairie plants, and they graze them down, but then they move on. They move over these long distances, you know, and historically as wild animals, very long distances, and those plants had time to grow back. And in the way that they graze selectively, which is very different from the way cattle graze, they actually sort of shaped a mosaic of prairie plants that provides habitat for lots of other prairie species. And this all generates a lot of life and a lot of biomass and a lot of soil carbon. And so I think Latrice encouraged me to think about bison grazing not just as a theoretical model that we use to inform how to better graze cattle, but that we actually do have to bring those relatives home to those landscapes, that they will be our teachers going into the future, and that as they adapt with those landscapes in the context of climate change, they will continue to teach us, you know, to adapt with them, to figure out how to be in balance with those prairies.
It seems that what the European settlers did to the buffalo is very equivalent to what they did to the indigenous people who lived in harmony, in synergism with the buffalo. So I wanted to talk about why the buffalo are so important to all the indigenous people on the areas where the buffalo roamed. In fact, I think it's a lot wider area than we realize. So let's talk about what that relationship is and how that relationship can also inform us about how to save the planet.
Yeah, so you're right. I mean, my understanding is the historical range of bison extends northward to Alaska and south to what's now Mexico and covers most of what's now the continental United States. You know, not Florida, not some of New England. If you get west of the Rocky Mountains, you know, you're out of their range. But otherwise, yeah, the North American continent was full of buffalo in relationship with people and prairie and fire. And I mean, I don't know the half of it. I look forward to continuing to learn more from indigenous people in the territory where I grew up about those relationships. I'm really excited to actually start seeing more buffalo on the landscape. I was actually lucky growing up in Montana to see buffalo in Yellowstone Park and on the National Bison Range as a little girl. And so they don't seem like this kind of phantasmic being to me. But I think in terms of that relationship, I think, you know, again, something that I really took from Latrice is this idea of buffalo moving around in order to make the most of what was available at certain times of the year. So bison had this complex seasonal migration, living in an arid landscape where, you know, you couldn't stay in one place all year round and make a living, so to speak. And native peoples on the prairie also moved around based on a really deep understanding of what was available where and when. And that mobility was really central to kind of sustainability of those ecosystems and that vegetation and ultimately people who were really interconnected with those plants and animals. And European colonization, you're absolutely right, sort of treated people and bison in a similar way in the sense of, you know, I mean, first of all, a horrible genocide. And then those people and animals who remained were fenced. You know, the landscape was fenced. It was carved up into these discrete tracts of private property so the forage could be assessed as a capital asset. And people were confined to reservations that were just a very small, piece of their former territory. And the result of all this is that neither the people nor the animals could move around in ways that allowed them to respond to the changing seasons. And that's sort of what's necessary. That mobility is just necessary to the ecology of a prairie. And so, the exciting part of this is that when Blackfeet people talk about their sovereignty, you know, and sort of liberation from these times of the Dawes Act and the boarding schools and all these horrible forms of confinement, there's such a strong synergy between the liberation and the regeneration. And that's actually one of the kind of big themes that kept coming through in my book, as I saw that over and over again, how tightly connected these struggles for liberation actually are to ecological regeneration.
You're listening to Locus Focus on Cable Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Liz Carlisle, who's author of Healing Grounds, about Indigenous Black, Latinx, and Asian American farmers who are reviving their ancestors' methods of growing food, techniques long suppressed by the industrial food system. And I want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBU during our spring membership drive. KBU receives 80% of our funding from our listeners, but only 10% of listeners are members. Help increase our member-listener ratio and meet our $56,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or you can mail a check to KBU FM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $12,000 thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Well, I want to talk now about another corner of the country. We're going to move to the southeast and to an area that was mainly farmed by Black slaves for hundreds of years. And the relationship between their liberation and their efforts now to reclaim their connection to the land. So let's talk about the woman that you met. She was in Georgia?
She's in North Carolina. So I got to speak with Olivia Watkins, who's forest farming. So she's growing mushrooms within forested land just outside of Raleigh, North Carolina, in a community called Holly Springs that's been in her family for 130 years. So she had an ancestor who in 1890 purchased this plot of land and was one of the first Black landowners in the area. And her family managed to hang on to this land over the course of a century. I mean, the 20th century, 98% of Black agricultural landowners were dispossessed. So, for so many reasons, violent mobs, lynching, and then this horrible discrimination by the USDA and this kind of financial racism that led to people not getting loans and losing their property in tax sales. There's this whole heirs property debacle where the way in which Black families were handing down property didn't square with white legal system. So anyway, it was just remarkable to meet Olivia Watkins and hear her talk about a form of agroforestry that was sort of conservation in two senses. So she was conserving this forested land in this rapidly urbanizing region. And so her land was this sanctuary for wildlife and soil carbon. but it was also, you know, it had been a sanctuary for her family in the face of racism focused at Black people. And she was also conserving Black-owned land at the same time. And that way in which she spoke about conservation in two senses really struck me.
Well, I was thinking about how during times of slavery that slaves would run away and hide in the woods and hide in the swamplands in the South. And I wonder if there's some residual memory of that that informed her desire to protect the forests on the land that her family owned.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's this really deep legacy with trees and woods in the Black diaspora. And as I was researching the book, I learned about these incredible African agroforestry systems, that predate the era of slavery. And then, women braiding seeds into their hair and taking plants with them on this brutal middle passage. People planting dooryard gardens, enslaved people planting their own agroforests around the areas where they lived to get through the period of slavery, to grow foods for their own subsistence. And then, something I didn't know about until much more recently, I actually read Monica White's book, Freedom Farmers, which talks about the whole period. I mean, she starts early in kind of Reconstruction era, but how these agricultural traditions actually were very helpful in the civil rights movement that, sort of feeding the revolution in a sense, and that Black landowners were really key to literally articulating a space for freedom. So, even Harriet Tubman was like an herbalist who knew a whole lot about, both medicinal and culinary plants in the woods. And this was critical to the work that she was doing on the Underground Railroad. So I think there is this really, really deep history in the Black diaspora with agroforestry and trees and the woods and the idea that these things can be allies in the struggle for freedom and liberation. George Washington Carver also is amazing to learn, having heard about him as like the peanut man, and then maybe a little bit more recently to kind of understand that he was a scientist advocating biological fertility in the early 20th century when everybody else in his field was so excited about these new commercial fertilizers. He was like, no, compost is a miracle. Why would we do away with that? But to really learn more about his context and that he was at Tuskegee and he was, his clients in a sense were Black sharecroppers for whom borrowing money to buy fertilizer was just basically like putting yourself back into the position of slavery, putting yourself in debt to these white planters. And so he saw that, working directly with nature and specifically with the materials in the woods that contributed to the compost that he was building, that was a way for Black people to achieve economic liberation.
Also, wasn't Fannie Lou Hamer into farming?
Totally. Yeah. So that's what I picked up from Monica White's book, Fannie Lou Hamer's Freedom Farm Collective. And Monica tells the story brilliantly in the book of how she had this Fannie Lou Hamer established this pig bank that allowed, families to have pigs and then contribute, from each litter back to this pig bank. And there were like hundreds of families participating at the height of this.
Well, I think it really goes to show how little most of us know about the connection that Black people in the United States have to the land. There's a lot about Black people disconnected from nature. There was a whole issue a year and a half ago or more about Black bird watchers, the one in Central Park who was assaulted basically by this white woman who was a bit racist. And what's interesting is to compare that and these stereotypes with this other story that you're telling. And I wonder if the people that you talk to are processing also this disconnect that so many Black people have with nature and with farming.
Yeah. Leah Penniman, who's a co-founder and co-director of Soulfire Farm in upstate New York, just an incredible model regenerative farm and food justice organization. A phrase that she often quotes from one of her colleagues is the idea that the land was the source of the crime, but she wasn't the criminal. And I think a lot of the work that Leah and her organization do with youth is kind of unpacking this land-based trauma and showing it to be what it is, showing it to be it's a problem of race-based oppression. It's not that Black people don't have this historical connection to land. And so I think those kinds of organizations are incredibly inspiring, I think, in replacing a very violent story with a very empowering story about how, Black people's ancestors did really important, innovative work to create regenerative farming systems, and young Black people can be part of continuing to build that knowledge and solving some really important social and environmental problems in the process.
What does she mean by the soil is the source of the problem?
The land was the scene of the crime, but she wasn't the criminal. Yeah. So slavery happened on land. And I think as basic as that statement is, I think sometimes, I myself forget that. I forget that slavery was an agricultural mode. It was an agricultural experience. And for Black people in the United States, it was the primary way in which people experienced agriculture was as a form of race-based oppression. And so that happened on land. And so it makes sense that if you descended from someone who was enslaved and you find yourself on land, that that memory would be present, that memory would come back up and it would be painful. And so that's part of the healing that I think white people have to support and have to make space for, to understand that, if we're talking about reparations, if we're talking about healing from slavery, you know, there's an economic piece of that, but there's also, people need to be made whole in a sort of spiritual and psychological way. People need to have the resources and space necessary to rebuild the very positive relationships with land that their communities had before that experience.
Well, I learned something very interesting a few years ago. My partner and I were making a film about food justice, and we discovered, so to speak, this urban farm in Richmond, California called Urban Tilth, which is, since we made the film, has really blossomed. They have a few acre farm in North Richmond, and they're really involved with helping North Richmond become a much more vital community than it's been. And what we were told by Doria Robinson, who was the director of the program, and her people were from Louisiana, and she talked about how all these people came to Richmond from the South, and a lot from Louisiana and Arkansas in particular, and they came bearing plants and seeds, very much as you're describing the slaves braiding seeds into their hair for the Middle Passage. And it was very interesting to realize how much agriculture was going on in the city limits of Richmond. And we, as we were filming, one time we were actually finishing filming and we were just kind of walking back to our car, and we passed by this guy who had an amazing number of tomato plants in his front yard. And we had a wonderful conversation with him. But it's something that you don't notice until you are opened up to it. And I wonder if you came across other kinds of urban farming in your work that's equivalent to Urban Tilth, where it's a lot of Black youth who are involved in this program of learning skills, learning leadership abilities, and also reconnecting to the land.
Yeah, I mean, Urban Tilth is just a phenomenal urban community farm in Richmond, California. And I lived in the Bay Area for about a decade. I went to graduate school at Berkeley and had a chance to visit a couple times. And it is just phenomenally inspiring to see people, you know, accomplishing food sovereignty for their neighborhoods, growing their own food, deciding, you know, what they want to grow and how they want to grow it, but also building all these really powerful social connections and ultimately building power to do things like, you know, protest the Chevron plant in Richmond and start to determine what their neighborhood looks like in other ways. And, you know, I ended up writing more about rural agriculture in this book, but one thing that really struck me as I was doing the research for it was about how home gardens have been translated from Mexico and Central America to parts of the United States where a lot of people who've immigrated from those places now live. And I didn't write a whole lot about that in the book, just a little bit, but I cite a couple people who've written more. Gabriel Valle, who's a professor within the California State University system, did a whole fascinating study in San Jose about these backyard gardens that are kind of tucked into the fabric of the city. And it struck me when I was speaking with him, he said, you would never know that they existed unless you were invited. They're not in people's front yards, you know, they're like in these little side yards. And it's, I've noticed too, you know, when riding subways and trains and, you know, you'll see sometimes a milpa in a backyard. And I think there has been in this part of the country, kind of a striking translation of these polycultural food systems on a very small scale. It seems to me kind of like a sort of a seed bank that's just like waiting for a big rain, you know, that if we poured just a little bit more public support into them, that we'd find that there are all these people with capacity to grow these, you know, local and regional scale polycultural food systems.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Liz Carla, who's author of Healing Grounds, about Indigenous, Black, Latinx, and Asian American farmers who are reviving their ancestors' methods of growing food techniques long suppressed by the industrial food system. And I want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during our spring membership drive. KBOO has trained thousands of people how to make radio all for free, thanks to the support you receive from our members. Please support this vital community institution and meet our $56,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or you can mail a check to KBOO FM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $12,000, thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Well, that leads us nicely to talk about the biodiversity of farming in the Latin American communities that have migrated to the Central Valley of California. So let's talk about the contrast between what you discovered and what people helped you discover in what was growing in some of these Central Valley communities and the incredible monoculture, which is what the Central Valley is so famous for.
Yeah. So one of the people I spoke to for this book is Aide Guzman. And I first, I heard Aide talk when she had just enrolled at Berkeley as a graduate student and she was starting her research. And I was, a fifth or sixth year graduate student. And she gave this really fascinating presentation about arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi. And so Aide's work is all about the connection between the biodiversity below ground. So that's the arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi that's really central to carbon sequestration, water storage in soils, basically all the underground processes that we really care about from a climate perspective and a regenerative agriculture perspective. And Aide's interested in how that below-ground biodiversity is connected to above-ground biodiversity, so the diversity of the plants that farmers are planting. And interestingly, there's actually not a lot of research into how this works in agriculture. There's quite a bit of research into how it works in natural ecosystems like forests. But ecologists are kind of assuming that agriculture just isn't biodiverse enough to actually drive much biodiversity underground. And particularly in major agricultural regions like the Central Valley, where you see a lot of these big monocultures, you know, of things like almonds or grapes, you know, in the past it was other crops, but these big expanses of one plant, basically. And so Aide proposes that she's going to do her dissertation and she's going to look at the connection between polycultures, biodiversity above ground, and biodiversity below ground. And she's going to do it in the Central Valley. And a lot of folks in the research community were like, oh, man, I don't know if you're going to find enough biodiverse farms in the Central Valley to do this study. But Aide, actually, she was born and raised in the Central Valley. Her parents came there as farm workers. They had a diverse small farm in Mexico, and for reasons we can talk about at greater length, like a lot of other people who were small farmers in Mexico, economically, they had to come and seek work here. Anyway, so she was born and raised in the Central Valley, and she knew other folks in these immigrant communities, and she knew that people had these small farms where they were growing polycultures, growing cultural foods, and, nobody outside of the immigrant community necessarily knew about it. Researchers hadn't been there. Extensionists hadn't been there. So she was confident that she could find these biodiverse small farms for her study. And indeed, she did. She used satellite maps and she drove all around Fresno for hours down country roads. And she took soil samples and she did this incredibly sophisticated analysis, genomic analysis on them, and found that the polycultural farms, the ones that had multiple crops, had two times as many types of arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi compared to the monocultural farms in her study. And so that's really just this snapshot of how that above ground biodiversity, all those different plants and all those different cultural foods are driving the diversity below ground that's so important for soil carbon sequestration, for the water storage in soils that helps farmers get through drought. And, you know, really that all these immigrant farmers, immigrant farm workers in some cases, who are doing some farming of their own for subsistence, are actually like bringing life back to this agricultural region that ecologically has become, you know, somewhat degraded.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is the relationship between plants and the three sisters. So let's talk about how they grow different plants together who actually nurture each other.
Yeah, so that's this classic polyculture, right? The three sisters, or the milpa, and I love this term, indigenous corn belt, from scholar Devin Pena to describe, you know, this whole area from what's now Mexico, I mean, even into Central America, up through, you know, Haudenosaunee territory in, you know, the northeastern United States, where indigenous people have, you know, been exchanging these seeds and then adapting corn, beans, and squash, the three sisters, to their region and growing them together. And yeah, this is just an amazing, you know, plant evolution slash, you know, human breeding achievement that you have corn, which is a staple food and sort of grows up really tall, and then beans vine around it and they fix nitrogen. So they're putting some nitrogen into this system. Nitrogen is what corn needs to grow. And then squash, it's basically a living mulch. It spreads out, you know, kind of at the bottom of this canopy structure and covers the soil, you know, helping to prevent erosion from rain and wind. And the whole thing just kind of works together, kind of apportioning light between these three plants that have different architectures. And it's just a brilliant model of how, you know, plants can work together. People can work with plants, and maybe people can learn from plants about how to work together and cooperate as well.
Well, another thing that was fascinating in your book was learning that a lot of what we think of as the organic farming movement, which we think started back like in the 1930s or something, but it actually goes back centuries in Asia. So let's talk a little bit about how the Asian immigrants who came to this country starting in the 19th century had an influence on farming in this country, and also what the techniques were that they were using for centuries, well, probably millennia.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting to me. So when I started to learn about organic farming in 2008, so just to back up a little bit, I actually worked for Senator John Tester, who represents Montana in the U.S. Senate. I'm from Montana. And when I, as a young person, got really concerned about climate change and was like, gee, is there anybody around me in my home state who's doing something about it? That's kind of when I found my way to the organic farming movement. And Senator Tester was running for the first time and talking about a green economy, and I was all about it. And so I got involved in the organic farming movement, and I was really struck by these two classic books that would come up a lot in conferences and in people's classes and in people's syllabi, once I started getting into academic work. And people loved these two books. And one of them was called Farmers of 40 Centuries. And one of them was called The Soil and Health. And then the guy who wrote The Soil and Health had also written a book called An Agricultural Testament. And what these books all had in common is they were white guys who went to Asia and realized that, you know, in both cases, they were agricultural scientists, one from the U.S., one from England. The English guy was supposed to go to India and teach the peasants how to farm in a modern way. The U.S. guy was going to China and Korea and Japan. And in each case, they were like, wait, you know, these cultures have really figured it out. They've been farming sustainably on the same pieces of land for, you know, hundreds, thousands of years. What are they doing? Oh, they're cycling nutrients. You know, they're mulching. They're using cover crops, living mulches, compost. Sir Albert Howard, who wrote An Agricultural Testament and the Soil and Health, based on what he learned from Indian peasant farmers. For him, it was compost, the indoor composting process. He was all about it. And so it was really interesting to me, like, oh my goodness, so much of the organic farming movement in the US and England was really built on these ancestral farming techniques from small farms in Asia, kind of via these two books.
It's interesting bringing it back to this country because there's a lot of Asian farmers, particularly in California, those who were able to get their land back after they were interned during World War II, the Japanese, that is. And then more recently, a lot of Southeast Asian farmers. So I wonder if you've had contact with particularly the Hmong and the Mien who have been farming in the Central Valley and all the way up to Davis for quite a number of decades now, and how they are still using some of the same techniques that probably are millennia old.
Yeah, I mean, what's just so painfully ironic is that in the early half of the 20th century, first half of the 20th century, this is just when Sir Albert Howard's work and Franklin Hiram King's work is starting to get promoted in the organic farming movement. And at that very same time, we have alien land laws in California and other states. And we have, you know, the first exclusionary immigration laws that are also targeting Asian people. And so at the very same time that the organic farming movement is sort of importing this Asian agroecological knowledge, the state of California and other states are basically telling Asian immigrant farmers, you know, we don't want you, you're not welcome. And so, yeah, I mean, you're right. You know, people had to, I mean, especially, like you said, Japanese American families who went through the alien land laws and then, you know, in some cases somehow managed to get some kind of foothold in farming and then, you know, were incarcerated during World War II, you know, for no reason other than their Japanese descent. And then, you know, some of those folks actually managed to get back on their original land or some other land. And I got to talk to one of the descendants of one of those folks for this book. So Nikiko Masumoto farms organic peaches and nectarines and raisin grapes in an area just outside of Fresno, California. And she's actually the third generation of her family to farm that land. So it was her grandparents who went through internment. And, you know, yet in this country, you know, that had incarcerated them and had told them they were unwelcome, they planted those roots in American soil and kind of said, like, you know what? We belong here. It was this kind of beautiful act of resistance. So, I mean, it's a fascinating story, what the Masumotos have done in the Central Valley. So Nikiko's grandparents, you know, they bought this 40 acres and they planted, they had to, all they had access to was this sort of like marginal land and they had to work that soil and bring life to it. And then Nikiko's dad originally did not think he was carrying on the farm. His parents tried to talk him out of it. He went and got a degree in sociology at Berkeley. But ultimately he came back for a lot of these reasons of just the power of that land connection and that insistence on belonging and creating space for others to belong to. And he actually converted the farm to organic. And this was a time when people were giving up on older peach varieties, you know, because of the trajectory of industrial agriculture and, you know, wanting to have really high production and fruit that would work well with these long supply chains. And he was sort of stubborn and was like, you know, these older varieties taste better. We care about food as craft and as art. And it was this, you know, I think kind of scary time in the life of the farm of whether they'd be able to continue. But that was a good time when, you know, chefs and grocers were starting to learn about, you know, heritage and heirloom varieties and how much better they could taste. And actually some Japanese American grocers in the Bay Area played a really important role with Berkeley Bowl and Monterey Market. And they kind of were the bridge to Alice Waters and Chez Panisse and other chefs that got into this farm to table movement. And now Nikiko is the third generation on Masumoto Farm and, you know, continuing on this tradition of growing really delicious peaches and nectarines. And also, you know, continuing on this tradition of of racial justice work and belonging work and storytelling. And also, you know, figuring out ways for different groups of Californians who've been oppressed by the industrial food system to really build alliances with one another.
I'm curious about if you came across much of the Hmong community that is also farming.
When I was researching this book, I did get to talk to a farmer in the Fresno area named Ku Mua. And I met her through Aide Guzman, who we were talking about earlier. Because when Aide Guzman was doing her research about polycultural farms, and she knew that although they're hard to find in the Central Valley, that some of the folks who are cultivating them are from immigrant communities. It wasn't just Mexican-American, Central American immigrant communities, but also Asian-American immigrant communities, and particularly Hmong farmers. And Aide was acquainted with Hmong people throughout her life. She went to migrant school with some Hmong folks as a little girl. And then when she was an undergrad at Wisconsin, she connected with the Hmong farming community around Madison, Wisconsin, too. So she was kind of aware that there was a whole community of Hmong farmers often growing cultural foods for their own community or other Asian communities or farmers markets. And so she introduced me to Ku Mua, who just has this astonishing diversity of crops. And I also spoke with this wonderful Natural Resources Conservation Services staff member who worked with Ku and who described how a lot of other Ku and a lot of other farmers of her generation had been familiar with a kind of crop rotation system that was used in Laos by Hmong people. And you know, it was a different context. It's a tropical place, steep mountains. It's not the same geography or climate as California's Central Valley. But folks were able to kind of translate that principle of wanting to rotate through different uses of land and rest the land in between crops. And it was interesting that Natural Resources Conservation Services staffer, who's himself Hmong, he's like, oh yeah, at NRCS, they call that conservation cover. So there's this kind of translation process going on where folks are able to bring those kind of ecological principles they know into a different context. And then also with this priority of growing foods that will meet the food security needs of their own community, as well as, Hmong farmers serve a lot of farmers markets, and they serve a lot of different immigrant communities and California communities at those markets. So Ku described to me that her diversity of crops was partly driven just by the diversity of her customers and the kinds of vegetables that they like.
You're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Liz Carlisle, author of Healing Grounds, about Indigenous, Black, Latinx, and Asian American farmers who are reviving their ancestors' methods of growing food, techniques long suppressed by the industrial food system. So in the remaining part of the show, I want to talk about that suppression by the industrial food system, because you're describing these wonderful, amazing, giving back to the land, carbon sequestering methods of farming, and that are also liberating for a very wide array of oppressed people. But how much impact are they having on the mainstay of agriculture around the world, which is industrial agriculture?
Yeah, well, you know, we have a lot of work to do on farm and food policy. So I'm very inspired by, you know, grassroots work that people are doing in local communities. I think there's a lot of great models out there. We have proof of concept for, you know, really vibrant regional food systems based on agroecological polycultural farms, you know, that mimic natural ecosystems. And now we need to get serious about things like, you know, the farm bill and the fact, yes, of course, you know, we use a lot of public money to support and subsidize agriculture. And I think that's appropriate because agriculture is potentially a public good. It deals with public goods. It deals with the public goods of, you know, land and water quality and climate, as well as, you know, healthy food. So I think we should have public money flowing to agriculture, but we need to align that public money with the actual public goods we want to support. And at the moment, what we're doing is we're using a lot of taxpayer money to mostly just subsidize, you know, these monocultures of corn and soy wheat being managed in the way that they have for the past 50 to 75 years, with a lot of chemicals, you know, that run off into local water supplies in the Gulf of Mexico and then volatilize into the atmosphere. So we needed to take those subsidies that are continuing to prop up this chemical monoculture system, and we need to refocus them so that what we're actually doing is in a targeted way paying farmers to provide ecosystem services and to provide healthy food to their communities. Those are the kinds of subsidies we should be feeding into agriculture. And then at the same time, we need to build up the kind of markets that are going to support farmers who are operating in that kind of food system. We need to much more seriously fund school lunch, which is an absolutely brilliant program, which a huge return on investment in terms of, you know, the health of our children in this country and their ability to learn, you know, and develop to their full potential. So we need to start spending more than, you know, whatever it is, a dollar a meal on school lunch. And then we need to use that procurement opportunity to support the kind of farming we want to see. That's what the Good Food Purchasing Program and the Center for Good Food Purchasing, which is based in Berkeley, are focused on. And they've helped, you know, double-digit numbers of school districts around the country to do this, to create these kinds of procurement policies. So we need to pay farmers for the right things, not the wrong things. We need to create, you know, public procurement opportunities for markets that support ecological agriculture and community food systems. And then, you know, one of the things that I talk about a lot in the final chapter of this book is the imperative of land justice. 98% of agricultural land in this country is white-owned. That is just not a land percentage that reflects what this country actually looks like. And so we've got a lot of farmers retiring. I think we need a public program to buy those farmers out and then make that land available to indigenous communities and farmers of color and the next generation of people that want to farm agroecologically and serve their communities.
Actually, there's a big concern here in Oregon because there's a lot of old farms that are being bought out by multinational corporations. This community of Sandy, Oregon, where I used to live, there's a Berkshire Hathaway realtor now at the east end of town, which is where the farmland starts. So I wonder how we counter that kind of pressure and that kind of money that would really turn everything in a very big, very different direction.
Yeah, we don't have any time to lose because you're right. Institutional investors are gobbling up this farmland from retiring farmers as we speak. Actually, the endowment of my alma mater, Harvard, is wreaking havoc in the Central Valley by doing this very thing. So, yeah, we need a public program stat that can get in there, you know, buy out retiring farmers. We all have an interest in making sure that that land is utilized in a way that's consistent with the public interest, because if we leave it up to, you know, basically institutional investors, people in the financial sector, to decide what's the best way to manage this land, you know, what they're thinking about is obviously not the actual living organisms on that land or the biogeochemical processes, but just like very short term, you know, how do we maximize the return on our investment? So we may need to not only create a program to buy out farmers so that we can have that land dealt with by public entities, but we may also need law, you know, land use law that is preventing the financial sector from becoming, you know, the major landowner in agricultural areas in this country.
Well, the other thing where time is running out is climate change. So I wonder how to make that case that going back to these indigenous methods of farming is really what's going to save the planet rather than cows.
Yeah. Well, so I have colleagues who do absolutely brilliant work trying to understand how carbon, you know, at the microscopic level is traveling through ecosystems and really trace carbon in soil to understand when it is and isn't getting stored. My colleague Francesca Cotrufo at Colorado State shares this great metaphor about the savings account of carbon and the checking account, and how some forms of soil carbon are available for being used for plants' daily needs, and others get stashed in the savings account associated with minerals and stay there for a long time. The long story short is that Deep roots in the ground all year long are the key to the savings account. And so you need perennial plants, which is what you see in natural ecosystems, a high balance of perennial plants. And then you need things like cover crops in the areas where you are planting annual plants. And then you need to minimize soil disturbance. So you can get really detailed on trying to track these carbon atoms. But then you could also kind of zoom out and say, you know what we know that we've known for a long time is that healthy functioning ecosystems cycle carbon and nitrogen really effectively. So if we want to make sure that carbon and nitrogen are in balance and not all in the atmosphere in the form of carbon dioxide and methane and nitrous oxide, if we want to see them cycling through in a healthy balance between soils and the atmosphere and other sinks, what we need to do is we need to have healthy functioning ecosystems that look like the natural ecosystems in whatever place we're talking about. And indigenous farming systems, that is their, you know, core, is that they're basically ways of raising food that mimic the natural ecosystem, that sort of fold into the logic of the natural ecosystem of that place. And if you want those kinds of farming systems to persist, and when we're talking about storing carbon, we're talking about, you know, thousands of years, you really need to pay attention to the nature of the relationship between the people in those ecosystems, tending and managing those ecosystems and the ecosystems. So it's not just a matter of like, oh, you know, we're going to steal the knowledge of the indigenous people and then we're going to try to do those same kinds of things over here on our own land. Like, A, that's wrong. But B, that's actually not a successful strategy, because the most important thing about indigenous land management, you know, that I learned in the course of this book, it's about that deep relationship. It's about being connected to that land, you know, so many generations back and so many generations forward, because that ongoing reciprocal relationship, that's what's going to ensure these relationships that last at the scale that you need them to for something like carbon sequestration.
Well, Liz, it's great to talk to you. I'm really happy to have you on Locus Focus, and thanks for writing your book.
Thank you so much, Barbara. It's been a total pleasure.
We've been talking with Liz Carlisle, author of Healing Grounds, and you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us reach our $56,000 goal during our spring membership drive by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.